It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law. You can also call us at 247-7282, and Wes is in the studio with us this morning. Good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
Well, we're going to go back to a topic that I think that I was on about a month ago, but I've been out a lot. I've been in court all over the place and depositions out of town and that kind of thing. Seems like that's fallen on Tuesdays a lot lately. So I've been out early and out of town. So, the topic I recall that we were maybe a quarter of the way through was will caveats. So I do want to go back to that and kind of tie off that topic a little bit. We've talked about that a lot on the program. I mean, obviously that's a very important area, certainly of our practice, as we end up defending those in many cases and we end up bringing those in many cases.
Right.
You know, we do so much estate work and estate related litigation at Harvell & Collins. It's something that, you know, we just kind of live and breathe. We deal with it. We keep up with the cases, coming down from the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of North Carolina. So it's certainly a very important topic. I mean, obviously, when we're talking about a will caveat, you know, a will is a very important document. We know that folks understand that, you know, obviously a will is going to control where assets go.
Right.
And those assets could be as simple as a home, or it could be millions of dollars. I mean, we it's a case by case type situation. So the will caveat basically starts with, you know, in the event someone has a will, they've executed the will during their lifetime, they passed away, then at that point in time, the will becomes public record because it gets put on record through the probate process. So in many cases, folks, family members, so on and so forth, don't really know much about the will or what the person did as far as you know, their desires go in their will until they die, unless that's been shared with others, because it then gets put on record. So then that's an opportunity for really anyone to go into the clerk's office in the respective county and look at the public record and look at the will and see what it says. So, in the event that there is, you know, a suspect, situation that arises with the will, as it relates to maybe when it was executed and whether the person had some
capacity,
lack of capacity issues, or maybe, you know, has left everything to the caregiver or has disinherited some of his or her kids.
Something smells fishy.
Something doesn't smell quite right. So, there's a right, that's specific, in our statutes, called a caveat. Some people call it a caveat. C-A-V-E-A-T, a caveat to a will, and that's a challenge to a will. And basically, the challenge to the will, generally speaking, needs to be brought within 3 years of when the estate was opened. So you can't do it, you know, in perpetuity. You can do it within a three-year period of time. But normally, these will caveats are brought pretty soon after the death and after the estate being opened.
When you say the estate being opened, the actual time of that being opened is when it's filed with the clerk?
That's right.
Yep. Okay.
The process is, you know, when the person has
passed. Not the death.
That's right. When the person has passed away, then the process is basically, you know, we refer to it as opening the estate. You take certain things to the clerk of court. Sometimes you have your attorney help you do that. Sometimes if it's a very simple estate, it's not necessary to do that. You may do it yourself without the assistance of a lawyer. But basically, you put the will on record with the clerk of court, the original will. That's important. You file multiple documents with regard to who the family members are, who the heirs are, generally what the assets are, because we might not know completely at that point in time. You have an opportunity later, and multiple opportunities later, once you've gathered more information, in order to be more specific regarding your accounting and inventory. And then the letters of testamentary are issued to the executor to handle the estate. So after all that's done, then if a party files a caveat to a will, normally, as we said before, there's a couple of areas that we look at primarily. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at, number one, whether there was undue influence. Number two, whether there was lack of testamentary capacity.
Right.
I'm going to come back to what those two things mm-hmm. mean in a minute. Could be that there's an issue on the face of the will. In many cases, the clerk would identify that, though. Let's say we don't have enough witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's only one witness and we need two in North Carolina, then that's something that the clerk is trained to look for on a day-in and day-out basis. Mm-hmm. So they're just not going to accept the document.
Okay? Right.
But if there's something else that may be a technical problem with the execution of the will that maybe the attorney catches, then that could be a basis of the caveat as well.
Mm-hmm.
So once that caveat is filed, then there's an order that is entered by the clerk that freezes the administration of the estate. That makes sense. We don't want to go forward with an administration of the estate and start distributing assets if there's
a challenge.
Yeah, perhaps these assets are going to pass in some other way than what is indicated, you know, by the will.
But when you've got 3 years, I mean, wouldn't a lot of those assets have already been passed if somebody waits a year and a half?
Yes. And obviously, as an attorney, when you're evaluating the case,
mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes we end up in cases where the estate's already closed and all the assets have mm-hmm. been dispersed. So the court does have the authority in a caveat proceeding, actually, as a result of a caveat proceeding, mm-hmm. in the event that the disbursement of the assets was in some other way, which you would expect it to be, because there wouldn't be any reason to bring a caveat otherwise.
Right.
The clerk of court has the right to enter orders requiring the return of assets.
Hmm.
So if they were
If they were
wrongfully or incorrectly dispersed assets, and then the jury comes back on the issue of whether this was the will or not, that it mm-hmm. wasn't, then there's another proceeding that then takes place for the clerk to then enter orders to bring assets back into the estate that were dispersed.
But that's the last thing you want to do, really, I would imagine.
Right. So you want to get ahead of this.
Yeah.
You want to get ahead of this for multiple reasons. I mean, obviously, in the event that the bulk of the assets have been dispersed out, then, you know, that frustrates the process. It makes it more difficult. And frankly speaking, from a strategy standpoint, if you're representing the caveator, the person who is challenging the mm-hmm. will, well, I don't know any attorneys that do that for free.
Mm-hmm.
It costs money.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lawsuit. Well, if you are on the other side of that case and money has been dispersed out of the estate to you
mm-hmm.
and that's in your possession, you would most likely, unless the court entered a direct order against this, be able to use those funds, which were otherwise estate funds, to pay your lawyer
mm-hmm.
to defend the case. So
right.
it's kind of a... maybe somewhat of an uneven playing field. If one side is paying their attorney out of their pocket and the other one's paying their attorney out of the estate. But the only way you can, you know, pay your lawyer out of the estate would be that in the event that the assets were already dispersed at the time that the caveat was filed.
Mm-hmm.
If it hasn't been filed, then the clerk is immediately going to enter an order that's going to suspend disbursement. So that puts everyone in a position where, okay, everybody's just going to have to pay their own legal fees dealing with this process.
Right, right.
Yep. So that's another, from a strategy standpoint, reason to go ahead and file as soon as there's an issue here.
If you have a question about what does it take to challenge a will, if you have any questions about maybe a situation you've gone through, you can give us a call, and Kenzie, you'll take that call right now.
That I sure will, at 252-247-7282.
We'll have more to come in a moment on Let's Talk Legal. And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And Wes Collins is with us. We have a couple of callers standing by. Let's go to CJ in Greenville. Hi, CJ.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you out?
Harvell and Collins, did my mom and dad help them with their estate planning?
Mm-hmm.
And they designated an acre to my nephew. And what they want to do now is change the location of that and possibly maybe give him a little more than that acre. Situation's different now than what it was then. He's actually started a little organic farm, and it's on a different side of the property, and he's going to need more acreage than what they originally allotted. How difficult is that going to be to go back in that estate plan that they did and change just the assigning of that particular lot? Because the rest of it was left to me, and that's fine. I'm not arguing any of it. I want him to get, you know, what's going to be best for him, and then the rest of it's mine. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So whose estate plan are we talking about here?
Is it your parents?
My parents, right.
And are they living?
My dad passed, but my mom's still alive.
Okay, so your dad probably left everything to your mom, is that right? And then upon your mother's death, this is when this takes effect, is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, really the
very
only...
Very straightforward now.
Very straightforward. It's a matter of just amending the will. If there was a trust involved, maybe amending that. That's a pretty simple thing to do. The only thing that may take a little bit of work, maybe even outside of the lawyer's office, our office, would be we need to obviously specifically identify this particular property that's going to, who'd you say it was, your nephew? Is that
my
right?
Nephew, correct.
Yeah. So it might be necessary if this is like
survey,
might need to get a survey, unless it's an identifiable lot that you already have a survey for.
Okay.
So if you get that survey, bring it in, then, you know, we're able to just pretty much lickety split, make some changes in the will, identify exactly what needs to go where. Obviously the decision maker with regard to this is mom. We want to make sure mom has the capacity to sign the document, you know, and
right.
Still is in good shape with regard to all of that. And she wants to do it. We have to take our direction from her.
Right.
She's the client, but not a difficult thing.
Is there a power of attorney now?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you can answer that, CJ.
Yeah, I believe she already has that in place.
Yeah, yeah. I would think that if she came and did a will with us before, she would also have a power of attorney.
Okay.
But we can't change a will with a power of attorney, though. So we
Correct.
Need to, obviously, we need to get her in. But I would say the preliminary thing you need to do before meeting with Cecil or me or whomever you meet with to make this change is the survey. If you don't have it, get it, bring it to us.
But it's not a real difficult thing, and it's not going to be as – like she was just starting over initially.
No.
And expense-wise, I mean.
It's a lot less. It won't be much at all.
Okay, great.
Excellent.
That's what we had discussed last night in our family meeting, and we're trying to figure out where to go from there.
Well, okay. I'm happy to hear that you're having family meetings around Thanksgiving.
We talk about
that all the time.
That's it. That's
finally,
exactly.
We got somebody doing it.
Yeah. Thank you, CJ.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's really trading one meets and bounds for another. Right?
That's right. We just need to specifically describe the property. I mean, it's easy to do it for like a lot block in a subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's rural property, well,
right. You
can't just say, I'm going to give him this little corner over here in that general area. Well, that doesn't do anything. You have to have that survey to identify, you know, what we're talking about.
Okay, let's go to Ron in Beaufort now. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Years ago, my grandmother was the receiver of two of her sisters' estates, and when my grandmother passed, she had her will where unnamed relatives got $1 each, and that saved us a lot because, you know, it ended a lot of squabbling.
Right.
My wife and I, we have a lot of relatives that we don't deal with, and instead of naming each one, how can we do the same thing? My grandmother did $1 to each unnamed blood relative. Can we do something similar to that? Because she has like several brothers and sisters, and I have nieces and cousins and stuff like that that we don't deal with. We don't even talk to them or anything.
Right.
How can I keep them from trying to attack us later on?
Yeah, that's
attack their will.
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, the first thing I would recommend is, you know, have your will done with a lawyer. I mean, I think that lends so much stability to the document. When you have an attorney involved, you have the witnesses, the paralegals, whomever it may be, the witnesses who are there, who are going to be available to testify in the event there's any issue that's brought up later on. You know, a good lawyer is going to dot those I's and cross those T's. So that's really sound advice to start with. Now, as it relates to the language in the document, normally in the event we're disinheriting someone who would normally take, which is maybe not your situation because we're talking about nieces and nephews here, then we, in the actual document itself, identify the fact that we have made the decision to not leave this particular person anything. And sometimes we go forward to say, not for lack of love and affection, but for whatever reason. We're not trying to be hateful in our document. We're just trying to be clear to show that we have contemplated this and thought about it and made this decision. So you can
but
also.
Do we have to name them though? Do we have to name them?
You don't have to, but that does show that you did think about that. Now that kind of carries out the same type. Effect as the $1 per person. But if you're talking about nieces and nephews and maybe folks that you really don't have much of a relationship with at all, then, you know, just be very specific in your will about where you do want to leave everything.
Right.
And as a further level of protection, you could provide to your attorney, you know, maybe a letter, maybe something that he has in his file or she has in her file indicating that you have contemplated that there are other nieces and nephews and so on and so forth.
You may not even be aware of.
Right, that I'm not aware of. And we have thought about this and considered it and discussed it with our lawyer and so on and so forth. And we've made the decision to prepare the will the way it's prepared and not leave them anything. That's just further evidence when you're not here anymore as to the fact that you thought about this.
The idea of leaving a dollar, that's kind of an old school thing, isn't it? I mean, it's not really necessary.
Yeah, that's a cool thing maybe you see in movies and that type thing. And I think that they probably did it you know, well before my 20 years ago when I started practicing. You don't see it that much anymore, but what you do see is you do see specific language indicating that this particular child's already received $100,000 during their lifetime. Well, I love this child, but I've decided not to leave them anything in the will because of that or something along those lines.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Ron.
Okay.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more here as we're talking about wills and also will and challenges to wills, too, here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. And I hope you'll join us. And if you'd like to join us, you can call like they did.
Yes, you can. And all you have to do is call 252-247-7282, and we will get you on with Mr. Wes Collins from Harville & Collins.
Well, Wes, a couple of very interesting cases there to bring about.
Yeah, no, great questions. You know, CJ's question there with regard to just a minor change to a will.
Prevents a major problem later.
Well, you know, her question was more along the lines, what do I do to get prepped up to do this, and what does it cost? You know, when you're talking about sitting down and doing a will, power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, living will, HIP authorization. These are kind of the standard things that you need here in 2018 in order to cover everything. There's a little bit of expense with that. There could be a lot more expense if you don't have those because it creates problems.
but you're not starting over fresh if you go back to the same lawyer that did the work at the beginning, and they're just having to make some modifications. So normally the expense related to that is not very high. So that was a good question, and I think able to give her some direction with regard to getting prepared in advance. Go ahead and get that survey so we know what we're talking about. Then it makes it even you know, more streamlined, easier. And then, you know, the second question with regard to disinheriting folks or being clear about that is, you know, really what we're talking about is what is the evidence that we've got, you know, that we thought about these individuals. And normally we deal with disinheritance and that type thing when we're talking about a spouse or we're talking about a child. And there are certain circumstances, like I said, where there are advancements that have been made during the lifetime, so on and so forth. And maybe we don't want to leave them the same amount as the other kids in the will, because that really wouldn't be an equal distribution.
Right.
So,
All right. Let's talk to Patsy in Havelock now. Hi, Patsy.
Morning.
Good morning.
My question is about a power of attorney. Can you get a power of attorney on someone that you know needs help? And is there any way that you can get power of attorney without their signature?
No, there's not. The power of attorney, that's a great question. The power of attorney comes from the principal, from the person who's signing it. If it's their choice for them to want to name someone as their person, their agent who can handle their affairs for them, then it's up to them to go through that process. Now, there's nothing wrong with helping them. If this is, you know, certainly there's situations where we know of people, whether it's in our church or community, who need help. And maybe they're in a situation where they have some type of cognitive deficiency that's maybe getting worse. It is certainly okay to help someone with that, you know, like that, help themselves, get them to the right attorney. You know,
as long as you're not putting yourself in a position,
you don't want to unduly influence.
But
you know, there's a fine line there. Now, in the event that we have someone who doesn't have a power of attorney, but is really in a difficult situation and maybe doesn't have a loved one to step up and take care of their affairs, or even if they do have a loved one, then in many cases, we're having to go through a guardianship proceeding.
Right. And competency hearing and then guardianship.
And sometimes, I mean, there end up being adults in the community who need help. They kind of fall into the cracks. They don't have the family support. In many cases, adult protective services with our DSS offices, they get involved. They want to make sure that our, you know, elderly folks are taken care of and not, not left to not get the food they need or shelter or whatever it may be. So, yeah, this is a common thing that we see in our practice, and there's lots of options there. But to go back to your question, the power of attorney itself is going to be something that's going to come directly from that principal, directly from the person who would purportedly need it, and it would be up to them as to who they're going to appoint in that position.
Thanks, Patsy.
Oh. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And again, if you want to find out more information about what your rights and responsibilities are and about how to plan your estate, too, call on the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law, 726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City.